From Nashville Public Radio, this is The Fine Print, an exploration and celebration of the written word. I'm Rebecca Bain. If you'd asked me a week ago who the greatest scientist throughout history might be, I'd have listed the names familiar to us all. Pythagoras, Galileo, Einstein, Marie Curie. People who change the way we think and do things through their scientific research. But now, since reading A People's History of Science by Dr. Clifford Connor, my viewpoint has broadened enormously. His highly acclaimed book turns its attention to the common folk who developed many of the principles of science: hunter-gatherers, farmers, sailors, miners, blacksmiths, and folk healers. People seldom credited for those contributions. Dr. Connor is a historian and author who grew up in Nashville, but now lives in New York City. He taught history for several years before deciding to devote his full time to writing, and he has published a number of articles on the history of science. Also two biographies, one on Jean-Paul Marat and the other on Colonel Edward Despard. Dr. Connor joins me today to discuss A People's History of Science, and I can promise the program will give you much to think about. I hope you can join us for this next half hour. One of the very first things that you say in the book, and I think we need a definition for two things before we talk more about it, you say science has always been a collective endeavor. Yes. So let's begin by discussing exactly what you mean about that statement.
Well, what I mean is that when people think about the history of science, what they've been taught in grade school and high school and college, and what they read is usually just biographies of great scientists like Newton, Einstein, Darwin, and so forth. And these men were very important. Things that they did were very important. But what I'm trying to show in this book is that there's so much more to the history of science than that, and that so much was done not by individuals but by occupational groups of people, and in particular, artisans, various types of craftsmen in the 16th and 17th century in particular.
The second definition, of course, then, is science. What do you mean by science?
Good question, because it's often debated. And what I'm trying to get away from is the idea that science is a purely theoretical endeavor created by people who just sit in a room and think about things. My definition of science, I try to get it to the most simple level possible, the most straightforward definition, is just knowledge of nature, all kinds of natural things, not just physics, not just chemistry, but nature of everything around us. What are things made of? How do they work? That sort of thing. So it's knowledge of nature is the basic definition that I work with.
All right. The Paleolithic and Neolithic technologies, you say, could not have existed without the prior acquisition of an imposing body of scientific knowledge, topographical, geological, astronomical, chemical, zoological, and botanical, of practical craft lore on agriculture, mechanics, architecture, and of magical beliefs that might also enshrine scientific truth.
That's a mouthful, huh?
It's a mouthful, but it's also a mind full of thinking about these things and how they interact. And we have had you cite your research meticulously in here. This is not a new concept, but it's one that's been slow to penetrate the general public.
Exactly. In fact, I try to make sure that people aren't saying, oh, I've discovered something new nobody's ever seen before. A lot of scholars have written about these things, but they have tended to write for each other, unfortunately. And maybe it's not their fault. I'm not blaming anybody. But the fact is there are a lot of scholarly books that have the things in them that that I'm using as my research materials here. And I do try to give credit where credit's due. This whole idea hasn't filtered down to the general reading public, and that's what I'm hoping to do with this book.
We're taught from early on that early man was not really smart.
Exactly.
You know, we had to progress a long way before we could be smart. And, of course, that's been challenged a lot. But my way of thinking when I started reading about Paleolithic era, Neolithic, all that, is it seems awfully smart to me to spend 4 hours a day hunting and gathering and then 20 hours a day doing pretty much whatever you want to do.
Socializing is what they did for the most part. They had apparently very nice little social groups and small, of course.
So why have we been so loath to give credit where the credit is due, that these were not stupid, dumb, semi-animals, that these, in fact, were living, breathing, intelligent human beings?
I'm not really sure, but I think it's probably just a matter of not thinking very deeply about it. And I think what people think is, gee, if I was out in the woods and, you know, didn't have my iPod and so forth, it would be boring and just be a stupid existence. And these people must not have been very smart if that's all they did all day was sit around and, you know, pick berries and hunt animals. But it's just not true. Maybe it takes a little deeper thinking into these things to figure that out. And, of course, anthropologists and paleontologists have discovered a lot of things now that evidence for these, for the intelligence of our forebears.
You know that the folklore they shared around the campfire must have been extraordinarily rich.
Yes.
Well, I am so glad you bring up some of the things that, when I've thought about them, I thought, how did the person first find this or figure out this? You know, who was the first person to realize that if you rendered animal fat, you could make soap? You know, how would you even think about that? But the one that's always been miraculous to me is pottery. And you talk about that in the book. How in the world could you figure out if you put clay in a really, really hot fire that it would turn into something totally different?
And these are things that nobody knows the specifics of, but, you know, you can reason out how things must have happened. And one interesting fact is that it's almost surely the case that it was prehistoric women who figured these out, because they were the ones that had the... there was a gender division of labor, and women were tending the hearth, so they were the ones with the fire, learning chemical things about chemical changes in food, first of all. I'm sure that there were certain accidental things, but then in addition to just the accidents, there must have been long, long periods of experimentation with materials, like different kinds of clays. And once it was discovered that mud hardened in the fire, there would be an attempt to try different kinds of mud. And and this is a very scientific way to proceed, experimentation.
Well, likewise with herbs, vegetation, those sorts of things, not only as foods, but for their medicinal properties.
Exactly, yes. And here again, you have a contribution of prehistoric women, mainly that women were the gatherers and men were the hunters. There was this division of labor, apparently. In retrospect, we can see that the drugs that they used were effective. They worked. And the broad range of them, the things that these drugs could do, is quite astonishing and impressive in the degree of information that they could hold in their heads without being able to write them down. As you were talking about the lore around the campfire wasn't just a matter of swapping stories, but conveying information.
Let's jump ahead a little bit here, because it seems
a few thousand years.
Several thousand years. This seems a good place to bring this in. Talking about medicine as it evolved, 17th, 16th century, so forth. Thomas Hobbes said, "I would rather have the advice or take physic from an experienced old woman that had been at many sick people's bedsides than from the learnedest but unexperienced physician." Mm-hmm. Like we have today, we don't always give as much credence as we should to people with experience versus people who spend time in a classroom but don't have the experience.
Exactly.
We don't give these old women enough credit.
Right. One of the major themes of the book in terms of medical science is that the educated medical men tended to do harm. Now, you know the famous claim that we shall do no harm, and I'm sure that's what they always tried to do. But the techniques, in retrospect, we can see that the bleeding, they call it phlebotomy, where they would open a vein or put a leech on you or something and take blood out, was quite harmful. And the standard technique for treating wounds was to put a hot cautery iron, in other words, to burn the flesh. Very painful. And these so-called heroic measures were not good. I mean, they in retrospect, it's obvious these were doing harm. Whereas the, in quotes, old women were letting nature take its course. They were, and they had milder drugs. The drugs that they used from plants were effective, and they were helped to ease pain and things like that. And so it's true what Thomas Hobbes and several other people I quote in the book said, that they'd much rather go to one of the old village women, the healers, female healers, than to the educated doctors.
Yes, I've forgotten to write down his name, but there's a doctor in here who's credited with discovering cauterization is not a good...
Ambroise Paré, yes.
Thank you, yes. Uh-huh. And he had used that, like all other physicians at the time, and they also poured boiling oil on gunshot wounds,
yes.
But he was out of oil, and so he went to one of the old village women to see if she had something to substitute. She told him how to make this poultice.
Right.
He brought it back, put it on the gun wound, and the next morning realized it was in much better shape than
yes.
they usually were from the boiling oil.
It was like an unintentional experiment. He had a bunch of soldiers. He had treated with boiling oil, and then when he ran out of oil, as you said, he treated a bunch of others with a poultice of oil of turpentine, I think it was, or something.
And onions, I think, was in it
and
as
roses
well.
Or something
yeah,
like
that's
that.
Yeah, that's it.
Yes.
Roses, onions, and oil of turpentine.
And so it was like an experiment. The next morning, he finds that the ones that were treated with the mild ointments were much better off than the ones he had burned with oil, and at that point, he said, I'm never going to burn these poor men again.
Skipping back again, the Greek miracle. You spend a great deal of time talking about that. Will you define that for us?
I think you may find this familiar when I say it. You've probably read books that said that the most important aspects of our intellectual life began in ancient Greece with people like Plato and Aristotle, that philosophy, theology, science, and of course I'm most concerned with the history of science here, that all of these things originated with the ancient Greeks, and there was nothing much worth calling science before that. And of course, that's what's called the doctrine of the Greek miracle. And yes, you're right, I do try to go to some lengths to dispel that as a myth. Well, first of all, the Greek miracle is based on the idea that even though the Greeks themselves, the Greek thinkers that are being quoted as having been miraculously innovative, they themselves credited predecessors in Mesopotamia and Egypt in the field of medicine, for example. We do happen to have, fortunately, just a little bit of documentation from ancient Egypt as far back as the 4th millennium B.C. that shows that there was a great deal of medical knowledge. Mathematics is another thing, whereas the Greek miracle seems to attribute all of mathematics to Pythagoras. And yet, I actually have an illustration in the book of a tablet from ancient Mesopotamia 1,000 years before Pythagoras that shows the Pythagorean theorem demonstrated. So I think that's as solid an example and well-documented as you can find.
I love, too, all the way through this, the people who are discovering, that's in quotation marks, things about the star, as if from the very first time a humanoid looked up into the sky, he didn't immediately begin to register, this is here and that is here, mm-hmm. and, you know, start
and they tend to stay the same every night. I mean, they move around, but they stay in the same pattern every night. Night after night after night after night, except for a few little things called planets. And the word planet
yeah.
meant wanderers, right?
And navigation, that also to me was a fascinating chapter because people have been navigating the oceans for a long, long time using the stars, using all different kinds of things. Early man.
Yes.
So... You know, they discovered again the word, these things, long before the people we give more credit to.
Right. One of the people that's often given credit. Well, of course, we've all heard of Columbus and Magellan and so forth, and they did important things. One thing I want to be sure that people understand is that I'm not trying to put down the famous people that we've heard of. I'm just trying to add to and show that they had predecessors, and they learned a lot from their predecessors. One of the people that's most often given credit for navigational knowledge, science of navigation and so forth, is Henry the Navigator, Prince Henry of Portugal. And I focus on him a lot in that chapter, as you noticed. He's given credit for teaching sailors how to sail outside, away from the sight of land, which must be hilarious to the sailors because, as I explain in this, there's probably never been a time in human history when sailors didn't sail outside the sight of land because it's actually more dangerous to be floating along in the shallows.
That example crops up over and over and over again of people, quote, teaching, end quote, others how to do. Well, another example you give are iron workers, mm-hmm. you know, and people coming along. Well, the magnetism. Let's just go ahead and go to that one because I found that one fascinating, too. William Gilbert wrote a book, The Magnet, in 1600, and he credits, it's in Latin. This is a learned volume for learned people.
Wasn't translated into English for 300 years.
But nearly 20 years before that, 19 years before, Robert Norman, in English, because he didn't know Latin, wrote The New Attractive. And almost everything Gilbert has in his book, Norman had in his.
That's correct, yes. And this is a good example of a couple of things that I cover in the book. One is the whole phenomenon of artisan authors who were writing in their vernacular languages. In this case, it was English, and another it might have been French or some variant of German. But these books were very important in the, to my way of thinking, in the history of science. And yet they didn't have much impact for quite a while on established science, the university science, the elite science, and because that was all conducted in Latin. The elite scientists or thinkers, philosophers, tended to ignore these artisan authors. But we can look back now and see the tremendous contributions they were making to knowledge of nature. And then along came people like Galileo and Francis Bacon and began reading those vernacular books and bringing all of that knowledge of nature into the world of what they called the Republic of Letters, which was the Latin scholarly area.
Our conversation with Clifford Connor, whose latest book is titled A People's History of Science, will resume after this brief timeout. I hope you can continue to check out the fine print. After the advent of the printing press, and as you show in the book, Gutenberg didn't, quote, invent the printing press. This was something that evolved, and a lot of people were doing it and trying to make it. He's just the one we give the credit to. Mm-hmm. After the advent of that, when books became more easily produced, therefore less expensive, therefore disseminated further, you said, the proof rooms of the early print shops where proofreaders, authors, and proofread authors exchanged ideas and criticized each other's works became in 16th century Europe far more important than the moribund universities as centers of creative intellectual activity, scientific and otherwise. That makes perfect sense, but that's one of those things that would never have occurred to me unless I had read it in this book.
Yeah, it's interesting. And my wife and I had a chance to visit one of the early printing places in Antwerp, Belgium. It was the printing establishment of Christopher Plantin. I don't know if that name rings a bell. If you know typefaces, there's a typeface called Plantin that he invented. And it's interesting because I worked as a proofreader myself at one point in my life. And you go into this place, into the proof rooms, and except for the fact that there's no electric light, it looks exactly like they were doing 1576 is when it was, 400 or 500 years earlier. They were doing exactly what we were doing today in terms of proofreading. Same marks, the same proofreading
really?
Marks and everything. Yes, yes. So that was fascinating.
Wow.
And you're right, that is where the action was in terms of the intellectual life of the day.
There were also...
Oh, excuse me, one thing. You mentioning Gutenberg, I wouldn't want to take away too much credit from him. I think he does deserve a lot of credit, but not sole credit, yeah.
There are a lot of things in here that disturbed me, though. As I said at the beginning of the program, made me so very, very angry. It's no secret. I mean, we still have this going on, that there's been a large block of the world's population, Caucasian, as we call them, who have felt that if you were not Caucasian, then you lacked certain intellectual capabilities. You were an inferior race. I loved you mentioned in here how for a long time, since Egypt was so important in all of these early things that we took over, that Caucasian society wanted to think that the Egyptians, even though they depict themselves in their own artwork as being dark-skinned, put forth this theory that, no, they were really Caucasian. They just had been out in the sun.
White people with suntans.
Yeah,
yes, that's the suntan theory.
Yeah.
You can see that I quote one of the leading scholars of Egyptology said that, and this is only the 1920s. I mean, that's fairly recent to think that that kind of ideology could have still been so strong then.
Well, here's another one that really upset me. This was in reference to the Johnson-Reed Act in 1924, which
yes.
restricted immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe, the Balkans, and Russia. And the quote is, "Biological laws show that Nordics deteriorate when mixed with other races." And the man who said that was President Calvin Coolidge.
Yeah. Amazing, isn't it?
Horrifying.
Fortunately, maybe I shouldn't even say fortunately, because you could get angry about this too, is what ended that? Why do we not think that way today? And it's because of a terrible tragedy in world history, and that is that the Nazis actually put these ideas into practice, and we saw what happened, and that's why we don't think like that so much anymore.
And they weren't the only ones. The Japanese,
yes,
during
yeah.
World War II, produced anthrax, dysentery, typhoid, cholera, bubonic plague to wipe out the world several times over. But then they did all of these experiments on over 3,000 human beings. I've listed them here, but I don't even think I want to say them over the air.
It's one of the most horrifying things that I've ever read. And you asked me, did it make me angry? It's terrifying, yes.
But what also made me angry, the American government chose to keep these atrocities secret, trading the research that the Japanese had done to avoid the doctors being prosecuted as war criminals. Now,
mm-hmm.
I know that our governments do a lot of things that the common citizens would be upset about, and they have their reasons, but I'm sorry. That makes me as mad as anything I think I've ever heard.
I can understand. This isn't in the book, but I read an article in the Times about a year ago about a reporter went to Japan, and he found one of these medical men still alive and still chuckling about cutting people open alive, vivisection of human beings. So they weren't punished for it, and they probably don't think they did anything wrong. It's amazing, isn't it?
It unfortunately just reminds me that just when I think I have imagined the absolute worst that the human race can do, there is always someone who can come up with something even worse than what I could imagine.
Mm-hmm.
However, let's not give people the idea that the book is full of things like that. No, we've got wonderful things to find out.
Hopefully
here.
It's not all a downer, yes.
Yes, interesting things. I didn't realize miners had such an impact on science.
Miners, not young people, but people that dig metals out of the ground.
Yeah.
M-I-N-E-R-S. Yes.
Yeah.
The subtitle of my book is Miners, Midwives, and in quotation marks, Low Mechanics. Low mechanics is in quotation marks because I don't want anybody to get the idea that that's how I'm perceiving them. But miners, as you say, they're first in line there because they've made tremendous contributions to the knowledge of nature. First of all, and most obviously, would be metallurgy. They're the ones that are around the digging up of the metal, the smelting, and so forth. But other branches of science that they've played a huge role in are, first of all, geology. Miners digging through the earth, the layers of the earth, and transferring that information to scholars, theorists, who then think about it and come up with their theories. These theories don't come out of thin air. They had to have data and information, and they got those from, first of all, from miners. And another major science that miners were absolutely critical to, of course, was paleontology. It was miners that brought up the fossilized butterflies and fish on the top of mountains. How did fish get here in the mountains, you know? And so that's where paleontology originates, with the fossils that miners brought to the surface and began to think about and wonder about.
I'll tell you, all of it was fascinating.
Thank you.
I mean, that's
it was
sincerely.
To me as I was writing it, too, I must say.
I dare say. How long did it take you to write this book? Because your research is meticulous.
Oh, thank you. Well, I began thinking about it when I was in graduate school 20 years ago. It came to mind, and I thought that would make a good subject for a book. But I didn't really start working on it in earnest, but I began collecting a little facts and data over, you know, the next 15 years or so. And about 3 years ago is when I began really sitting down to write the book in earnest.
Well, you have to be very pleased at the reception that it's gotten. I mean, your book was on the cover of the New York Times Book Review.
That blew me away. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah. I'm glad your hard work was rewarded, and I'm glad we have this book ourselves.
Thank you.
Dr. Clifford Connor, whose latest book is titled A People's History of Science. And that does conclude our program for today. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you will join me next week as well, when together we'll check out The Fine Print. For Nashville Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Bain.
The Fine Print is produced by Rebecca Bain and Scott Smith for Nashville Public Radio. You can find out about upcoming programs or listen to past programs at our website, wpln.org/fineprint.